And welcome to the second year of The Double Disillusionists. My name is Dom Knight. Happy New Year, Andrew P. Streets.
Oh, it's incredible to be here. It feels like it's been a year.
You've had a bit of a quiet time. Nothing much has happened for you since the last time we chatted.
Just sort of kicking back, relaxing, maxing, having offspring. It's been very, very quiet and screamy and not very sleepy.
There are more P Streets in this world than there were at the end of last year.
This is true. There is a very good thing. A fresh new P Street, a James P Street.
Brand new P Street. So hello, James. What kind of a world are we bringing him into?
We really planned this badly. Although he does have quite big hands for a baby with quite long fingers. And so we've decided he is the anti-Trump and he's come to save us all.
Has he got any bathrobes?
Ooh, he does have some nice Terry Towelling numbers, actually. They tend to have feet, but still, you know, I think the thinking is very much along that line.
Now, look, let's be clear at the time of record, because things are changing very quickly in Australian politics. It's 3:24 p.m. on Tuesday, the 7th of February. Things are changing by the moment. I'm very pleased we have Dee Madigan with us once again from Campaign Edge. She's the founder and creative director of that. She wins elections for people. You've probably seen her on Gruen. Her book is The Hard Sell, in which she shares the wisdoms, for some reason, that she charges for, Dee, various clients. And so, Dee, lovely to have you back.
Pleased to be here on this rainy, rainy day.
It is.
So much has happened. It's raining here in Sydney. It's raining probably inside this. It's raining Corey's.
It is.
Hallelujah. It's been a crazy day.
It has been a very colourful day. Already, first day of Parliament, and already we have one more independent Cory than we had at the beginning of the day.
Yes, the Senate met today. There were various resignations and disqualifications. A Senate comedy roast, really, was held in the Red Chamber today, Andrew.
Indeed. So Cory Bernardi has quit the party, and whatever is the exact opposite of a surprise, providing an exciting opportunity for senators across the political spectrum to spend Tuesday trying out their best insult comedy stand-up routines. So does this move to the crossbench mean that we can finally afford Cory the same level of quietly dignified respect that we give to his peers like David Lynehelm, Malcolm Roberts, Pauline Hanson, and of course the now-deposed people's poet, Rod Cullerton?
Oh, Rod. We barely knew ye.
Who was in Canberra today, by all accounts. I noticed that in one of the
public
reports.
Gallery of the Senate, embarrassingly.
Presumably he was just turning up with some bin bags to kind of clean up the last of his office.
The one nice guy in One Nation. I'm not going to say the one sane member. I'm just going to let his words speak for himself. But let's start, Dee, with the Cory situation. How big a deal is it? Obviously for him, he thinks this is the start of a Trumpian revolution. Is he right?
No, I don't think so. I think he was expecting George Christensen and Abetz to leave with him. I think it's pretty embarrassing when you leave to start a party and there's one of you there.
All the bets are off.
Yeah, exactly. So,
isn't it always embarrassing when you start a party and you're the only person there?
Yeah, yeah. And, I can't see how it ends well with him, but it was pretty funny today in the Senate watching Brandis basically say, you know, we're going to treat him with respect, and then just sort of spent the next 10 minutes slamming him. You were, you know, voted in as a Liberal and blah, blah, blah. So that was good. Penny Wong got some good one-liners in. Sam Dastyari said, why would you leave the party when you're in control of it? Which is pretty valid, given
fair
the
point.
Right wing seems to, you know, be complete control and then he's left. It's like, well, what more did you want?
Well, that's something that one of the many zingers that Penny Wong got in what I thought was a cracker of a speech. I basically went, should she be the opposition leader? This is pretty good stuff. Basically saying that it's never enough. You know, whatever they demand, it never satisfies them. And so he's gone off and taken all of his toys with him and 5.5 years of Senate time.
And written a manifesto. And I don't know if you've read it. I've rewritten it and released my own version on Twitter.
You normally charge for that. Yeah. I think this was free for
It
you.
Was the biggest load of, you know, just meaningless kind of guff. It's exactly what you'd, you know, expect from Cory Bernardi, who's not one of our great thinkers.
Oh, please. The conservative revolution. I thought it was... I thought the bit where he overestimated the amount of terminations in Australia by a quarter on any plausible number was a nice touch.
Yeah.
I feel like, though, if you're going to speak for the silent majority, maybe more silence could be tried. But my favourite take on this whole thing came from Dennis Atkins in the Courier Mail, who pointed out the brilliant timing of this, which is right after, moments after getting back from his trip to the UN to just confirm his view that it should be abolished completely. A moment, and you had to be a member of a major party to get that gig. And so he does that, goes and has this beautiful time, you know, on the taxpayer's dime, comes back, oh, what a guy my own way, within seconds of pretty much touching Australian soil.
Yeah. And there's no reason for it. Nothing's changed in the 7 months or whatever. So
no.
That's the thing. There's been, and he said, oh, well, it really was because of, the, you know, when Tony Abbott was replaced. It's like, well then why didn't you do it then? But now he's also apparently...
Why did you run for Turnbull?
Exactly. And now he's also apparently fallen out with Tony Abbott because Tony Abbott...
The leaking.
Because Tony Abbott didn't leak even to the... I wouldn't leak even to the Australian, he said, because I don't think they're leaks. They're just actual ordinary phone calls between
just
politicians.
A beer with
Shanahan, yeah, pretty much.
No, look, it is fascinating. What he's trying to achieve by this particular move, other than more publicity and presumably a sweet deal with Gina Rinehart somewhere in the picture, because Malcolm Turnbull's great success as Prime Minister, and there aren't many, but I'll give him credit for this one. He has brilliantly kept both sides equally disappointed. The left are disappointed, the right are disappointed. He's done practically nothing as Prime Minister except essentially just keep the nation on kind of moderate boil, just sort of keep mucking along, and no great disasters have befallen during his watch. But yeah, it's just hard to know how anything he hasn't done could be considered offensive. Chris Kenny had an article today saying that, you know, sort of trying to suggest that the left, he was moving too far to the left, but he hasn't moved anywhere as far as I can see.
It's hard to move when you don't have a backbone.
Backed away from everyone. Oh yeah, there you go.
Well, and I think that this whole thing of disappointing the left and the right is about to yet again become a huge deal, because you know there's the rumours of a block of moderates trying to move for a free vote on marriage equality. And so once again Turnbull has got this spectacular choice between: does he infuriate the right and galvanize them into actually moving against him, or does he disappoint what remains of his base within the party?
I think,
or does he just sort of continue on the current thing, which is both?
Well, this is what I there's all this talk. It's about he's got to appease the right. Look at Trump. Okay, but what we have to remember is what Malcolm needs to do is get the middle, not the far right.
Malcolm, you know, in the middle.
Even if they go Cory, they'll go preferencing to Lib. So they need the middle, and that's the moderates. And they seem to be forgetting this, which is why he really, if he was politically smart, and I'm increasingly thinking he's a political idiot, is to allow a free vote.
Well, this is the thing. It's the perfect issue to go for, really, for him.
Absolutely.
It's completely in his core brand. The majority of people support it. It'll get up if he does it. It would probably be his major legacy if, as we expect, he's not going to make it to the next election. And the thing that he needs, surely the only way he can hold on is if his poll numbers improve. I mean, he arrived claiming that poll numbers were the problem he was there to solve. He is instinctively, who knows if he still is, but he certainly has been popular for many years. For all that time he was in exile in his leather jacket on Q&A, people loved him preemptively based on what they thought he would do. Surely the only play now is to try and get popular support however he can. He's got to disappoint some people, or he's going to end up getting kicked out, either by his colleagues most likely or by voters at the next election. The gap now is massive in the two-party preferred.
Exactly, and if you want to change the polling, you appeal to the swinging voters. You don't appeal to your base, who are not going to go the other way anyway.
But can he actually do a vote on marriage, a free vote on marriage equality, just given the terms of what has been, you know, a pretty heavily leaked coalition deal with the Nationals? I mean, the Nationals made very, very clear that their support for him as leader was contingent on a bunch of things, including no ETS and no move on same-sex marriage. I mean, if he stared down the Nationals at this point, while they're particularly baity and feeling like they have a very big incentive,
he has
not to fold in the face of.
But where are the Nationals really going to go? You know,
well, they're just all going to join One Nation.
God.
Unless One Nation fall over first, it's really a game of chicken at this point.
One Nationals, the brand would be absolutely. Easy to put together.
That is a coalition waiting to happen, and almost certainly will.
But the thing is, we know he has this ability to make the bold play. He did it when he ran for the leadership. That was, you know, the numbers were okay, but it still showed that killer instinct that we know that he supposedly has. If he doesn't try it, if his only hope is that there's no clear alternative, given that he has successfully neutered Scott Morrison by making him treasurer, where do they go? I don't know, but that... Possibly back to Abbott.
But the thing is, he's a confidence player, I think, and he's lost confidence now. And what he should do is almost just, you know, fake it till he make it. He's clearly someone for whom life has worked out, you know, reasonably well. And you can
He was raised by a single father.
Oh my God.
In a rented
apartment in Rose Bay, and went to a bloody good private school. Yeah, woe is me.
Have you ever had to choose between Harbourside Mansion?
It's tough.
They wanted him to downgrade to Kirribilli. I mean, it's a.
So, but I do think you've got a person there who has cruised through life a little easily and has not got what it takes to actually play those sort of confidence deals when things aren't going well for you. And that takes sort of, I think, a really good politician, and Malcolm Turnbull is not.
Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, certainly what was the famous Keating line that, you know, he's brilliant, ruthless, but lacks judgment. Isn't that the – I mean, that's the big question. But he certainly – in his legal and his business career, he must have at various points made a big gamble. And I can't see what else he does from here. I don't see how, you know, the pendulum swings back towards him naturally at all. It's go hard or go home, I think, at this point.
No, well, what's interesting is now the moves on coal from him as well. I mean,
that is very strange.
That
is
so very clean now. That's the beauty of it.
Just all of a sudden got sparkly.
Yeah.
So that's, you know, these lurches to the right.
And to be fair, it is cleaning the Barrier Reef beautifully. It's never been whiter, the Barrier Reef.
Look, when I was up there when I was in Port Douglas sort of late last year, I mean, like, it is, that coral is looking
minty fresh, yeah.
Minty fresh. Yeah. It is white, it is sparkling, it smells interesting. It's great. Everything about it is working.
So that was certainly odd. I mean, the National Press Club speech, I don't know what he was trying to do. It seemed to be a kind of hashing together of a lot of the same kinds of lines. Look at the economy, our great plan for jobs, innovation, all that sort of stuff. And that's all very well, but no one cares about that stuff. Probably we should, but demonstrably we don't. Isn't that right?
That's right. And there's stuff that he hasn't sold in 7 months, and yet they're all stuff we'd heard before. And he went out again trying. It's like, you know, there was nothing he said that made it any more sellable than what he'd done before. There was nothing new and exciting in there. At least he didn't use the term, I think, agile.
It was only a reboot in the sense that when you reboot a computer, it's exactly the same as what it was.
That's exactly right. And it was probably an opportunity to at least sort of change the narrative a little bit, or bring something else in that might have got the attention of the media in a positive way, rather than the sort of yawn fest I thought that it was.
To be fair, if there is a win to be had with his press club appearance, it's that the fact that there was nothing really in it was immediately overshadowed by the fact that he'd given $1.75 million dollars to his own party, and that he'd had a disastrous phone call with Donald Trump.
That's true.
So in a lot of ways, that's a win.
Have you seen how the media spin now is coming out in the papers? It's like, Donald Trump was going to renege on that until Malcolm got on the phone. It's sort of the spin. It's like, it's too late, guys. When you want to control something, you start the spin first.
I can completely believe that that's true, but also who cares? I mean, if he pulls that deal off, that will be, I guess, delivering one thing in terms of what the coalition tends to like to do in terms of stopping the boats, all that kind of stuff. But surely he needs more even than that, because the starting point of him being prime minister was what Tony Abbott did. And though he didn't actually manage much, for instance, a budget, he did, inverted commas, stop the boats, tax, all that stuff. He did reset that stuff. So delivering on that stuff is no argument for Turnbull at all.
Yeah. Well, I mean, this is the big problem with the refugee deal. Leaving aside the fact that it's not going to happen, I mean, my guess is that the best possible outcome is going to be a handful of Christian families from Nauru might get resettled.
They're not going to,
which will be great, by the way. Just to be clear, anybody getting out of Nauru is definitely a plus. But they're not going to be taking a bunch of single men from Manus Island, predominantly Muslim, predominantly from the countries that Trump has already made a big deal about not letting into it to the US. And so, but even if that all happens, it just means that Turnbull has fulfilled one very small, it's not really a win, it's a not failure. And anything below that, and I don't think that there's any chance of that happening, so anything below that is going to be a failure. But there's no way for him to win out of this.
No, what's the most disappointing thing is that Tony Abbott failed for being Tony Abbott. you know, for standing up for the things that he believed in. Yeah. Turnbull is actually going to fail for not standing up for the things that he believed in. And at least Tony Abbott could sit back and say, well, these were the things that I, you know, did, thought and did. Turnbull's literally going to sit back when he loses the prime ministership and think, I stood for nothing and that's why I lost.
Abbott,
I
mean, well, Abbott didn't die wondering. You know, no. He's comprehensively proved that Australians thought that, you know, knights and dames were a terrible idea. Yeah. He'll never be wondering, what, if only I brought back knighthoods, maybe I could have stuck around.
Well, this was Penny Wong's great line from today, the which I wrote down because it so impressed me. I don't think Tony Abbott was much of a prime minister, but he was a hell of a lot better at being Tony Abbott than Malcolm Turnbull will ever be.
It beautifully sums it up.
It just feels like John Gorton all over again.
Well,
he's a man who is going to end up falling on his sword, almost certainly.
Was his middle name Grey, or is that an adjective that people use about John Gorton? Look, but that's the thing. I mean, what is the point of Malcolm Turnbull being Prime Minister right now? I mean, it's great for the CV. Okay, fabulous. But
he's going to get some sweet jobs
towards the end
this.
of his career. He has all the money he could possibly want. Surely,
well, he has 1.75 million less of it than he did while ago.
Surely the results are the only point in keeping the job. It's not worth being Prime Minister just for the ego trip of it, particularly when you get your ego gets smashed every second day by having to cave to the right. I don't honestly understand what his game plan is from here. And Andrew, as you will know, throughout the whole time I've been doing this podcast, I keep expecting there's some clever master plan that Turnbull has an idea of what he will do. And perhaps he does have a whole long list of things he'd like to do if he ever gets popular enough to be able to start making demands at all.
But he did. He started with a massive amount of political capital. He could have done those things.
But also,
like,
with
as
the
much as
deal.
The right, yeah, as much as the deal with the right was there, with his polling, when your polling is that good, you can turn to those people and say, "No, I'm doing this." And as mad as they'll be at you, if your polling continues up there, they will back off. That is how politics works. And the fact that he either didn't understand that, or I don't know, maybe the right had more on him. That's the most extraordinary thing, that he's burnt capital. He could have done stuff.
Well, it's the same with Rudd. I mean, Rudd had 2 years of being the nation's sweetheart. Okay.
That's because they didn't know him.
Yeah, but, I know, but look, GFC, all that kind of stuff. His colleagues started to worry, but they didn't do anything while he remained popular. And Rudd could have, I mean, even Obama's first 2 years, and he had all the capital in the world, he had all three elements. He could have done whatever he wanted, really. And leaders don't, if you don't use that goodwill, you don't get a second chance, usually.
And you generally, when you're a leader, your polls are generally never as high as when you first come in.
So Trump is really just cruising at the moment on his massive popularity.
Trump and his bathrobe. I don't own a bathrobe. So you own a hotel chain. No. You own a freaking bathrobe, mate.
That's why I think same-sex marriage is the issue. It's a question of civil rights. Every other country, English-speaking country in the Western world, has done it. It's a festering sore and an embarrassment.
Oh, it's an easy win if he did it, and also if he doesn't do it, as looks likely. Sorry, when I say it, if he doesn't legalize marriage equality, then it's going to keep doing what it's currently doing, which is it's going to be a dripping wound. There's no way to eliminate it as an issue.
Oh, you think
beyond
that.
Bringing it in.
You think that, but Barnaby Joyce said to the party room that if the ministers simply stopped talking about it, it would go away.
Yeah, that's how it works.
Only people in Oxford Street and George Street care about it.
That's so apparently. True.
Oh. Except for the poll that showed that I think every electorate except for one had a majority in favour of it.
I've sat in so many focus groups over the last couple of years, and they can be focus groups of Liberal voters, One Nation voters, you know, every kind of voter, and consistently it's like, oh, why don't they just get on and do it? No, you know, we don't care, just bring it on.
It's the closest thing to a no-brainer on the table at this point. Well, I think despite this excellent advice, which you may well not hear, how long has he got, Dee? What do you think's going to happen?
There were some pretty interesting Dutton rumours. Don't even laugh, because we've got mashed potato coming up.
Oh, my goodness.
I know, right?
But I'm sure in Dutton's head that's viable, but in how many other people's heads?
Well, the thing is, one of the reasons that he might survive longer than he should is because of the lack of who do you go to. Now, 6 months ago, you would go Morrison. Mm-hmm. He's done an appalling job.
He's been hockeyed out of there.
Totally, totally. So, yeah, when Dutton's looking like your viable alternative, your party is in all sorts of trouble.
Every new treasurer that comes in, I'm left with more respect for how ridiculous Wayne Swan didn't look in that role. You know, a bore, and he certainly had the personality to be a treasurer. But, no, it is clearly a very hard job. You've got to get up and sound convincing about numbers. Not easy for several of the recent incumbents.
And particularly if you have a party room who keep, like, going to the amount of tools that you've got to use as treasurer and going, okay, you can't use any of these.
Well, that 6 months after an election, a turn to Dutton, it seems. I know Australian politics has been utterly ridiculous and unpredictable for many years, but that seems a bridge too far.
Well, I think we should look at history and say, who in the Liberal Party has got the charisma and the joie de vivre, I think, to become the next Billy McMahon?
Julie Bishop, but no, but she won't go there.
Well, see, I did wonder if it would be Bishop, because actually, I mean, this isn't unique to the Liberals, but there is a rich history of when everything goes to shit,
give it to a woman.
Give it to a woman.
Look at Christina Keneally and Anna Bligh. You end up burning your best talent.
Exactly.
Yeah, absolutely. But
Joan Kerner.
Also, you know, if she gets...
Hello, Gladys.
Yes.
But
welcome aboard.
But what we found with Kevin and with Julia is, as much as the backbenchers or most of the party liked Julia Gillard, when your imminent political death is approaching, you know, as you know that you're heading into an election and you are going to lose your seat unless something changes, then all bets are off, and that's when a change will absolutely happen if they think it will save their political skin, regardless of what it will mean to the Liberal Party and all, and brand damage and all that sort of stuff. Self-interest will kick in and they will get rid of him before the next election.
Yeah, well, presumably they will. I just don't see how there's any option that isn't less bad than fixing it, because it's really down to policy. I don't think anyone has an inherent problem with Turnbull as Prime Minister.
I'm not sure. I think they do now.
They might increasingly. Yeah.
Yeah. I think. But
the
I
stuffed
think
shirt factor is really arced up.
It's what does he do? What does he stand for? But I think if you were asked, you know, the average Australian, what are Liberal Party policies or what have they been, people would struggle to answer.
Stick to the plan, D.
Jobs and growth. Jobs and growth.
Yeah, but where are the jobs?
All right. Let's shift across the aisle then, and look, Bill Shorten had his chance to impress the nation, to galvanise us into supporting him. Labor are miles ahead in the polls, but from what I understand, he still hasn't managed to unseat Malcolm Turnbull as preferred PM, which is interesting because that's an unusually wide gulf there. And, I mean, I must say, hearing Penny Wong today, I was kind of going, yeah, she'd be pretty good at that job. What do you think, Andrew, of Shorten's performance?
I actually think he's been pretty strong. Like, I think I'm as susceptible as anybody to the kind of the narrative that Shorten is a weak leader who nobody likes. And, you know, which seems to work every time I think of him, as opposed to when I actually see him speak. Like, most of the time lately, he's been actually pretty good on his feet. Which, and I think it's like the exact opposite problem that Malcolm Turnbull has, whereas people just assume he's a smart, capable, articulate guy until they see him speak, and then they go, oh, hold on, this is all falling to pieces. And Shorten has the opposite problem, that everybody underestimates him, and then when he's actually in Parliament sticking it to his opposite number, he's normally pretty good. And he certainly, I think he did a far better job at the National Press Club than Turnbull did, in that he actually articulated some sort of vision. So I don't know that Australia is going to necessarily fall in love with him. And I mean, and I've said this before about him, that I think he would actually be a pretty solid PM, because I think he's a very good negotiator. And everything that we're seeing in Australian politics suggests whoever is in the PM's chair after the next election is going to have a very fractured Senate, is probably going to have to pull together, perhaps even in the lower house, do some fairly nimble negotiating. And we need somebody who knows how to do that, because the coalition has proved time and time and time and time and time and time again they're lousy at this.
Well, it is certainly easier to get, at least in theory, a Labor government to do its job, because you've only got one bunch of people to negotiate with. And if the caucus decides something, it happens. You don't have all this freelancing and internal sniping, except for Kevin. but as a rule, you don't, and you don't have the perpetual problem the coalition seems to have now, which is that you can't, if the far right get their head, as they did under Abbott, as the Nationals want them to do, they become unelectable. So that Labor wouldn't necessarily have that problem, but they still are, you know, they're clearly heading to win if nothing else changes. What do you think, Des, for someone who's been out listening? I don't know how much you can say about Shorten.
I think Shorten's doing well. When he speaks, he's lost that kind of sing-songy thing. I think he's
better. He sounds less like a kindergarten teacher.
But also he's you know, pulled together a pretty cohesive kind of group. There's no, you know, infighting and bitching and things like that. Having said that, the Labor Party, you've always got the left and the right, and there's always going to be when it comes to policies, you know, a bit of argy-bargy. But it's not the same as the Liberal Party's centre and right. And I think it's because the left are driven sometimes by ideology, but not by religion, whereas with the Liberal Party, the right are driven by religion, and that tends to just bring out the sort of, I don't know, the...
Well, it's harder to compromise.
Totally, because if you actually believe, you know, in this sort of person in the sky and these kind of things, you almost can't if that's your kind of belief.
Well, that's where the same-sex marriage thing...
Totally. But if you think the Labor Party, I mean, has been incredibly unified now for... Since Kevin left.
Yeah.
Weird, huh? and look, Bill Shorten's I always find it funny when people say, oh, he's not popular. He's pretty popular within the Labor Party. He always has been, because he was really effective when he was on the union side.
Exactly.
And yeah, and he's one of those people that I always thought sounded much better in real life than when I used to hear him deliver in public. But I think that now that's getting a little bit closer. He's a little bit better. He's a lot more confident after the last election win as well. And I think his team, he has like a really solid team around him, that they're experienced, but they're also young enough that it feels like there might be people there with some vision.
Well, I do think that he needs more drunken speeches to go viral, because I know that my moment with him was when I saw him during the Royal Commission, having clearly had a few under his belt, and just sort of holding forth in a pub. And I was like, oh, he's very articulate when he's
successful.
When he's half cut and passionate.
I think we all are, aren't we?
Well, this is true. I think they need to like start, you know, it should be more like a TV audience. Everybody should get like two champagnes when they enter the chamber, and then sort of...
So before question time, sort of happy hour. Sort of before question. Yeah, do you know what? I am totally for that.
Get them a little bit
soused. Get their ratings up.
Yeah.
Question time. No, well, I mean, as always, all Labor has to do is not stuff up, and they're there. And this is the thing that's really fascinating. The mistake that keeps being made was certainly made by Trump. He's making it every day. Abbott made it as well. Is that when you're the opposition and people vote you in because they don't like the government. I mean, a lot of people felt that Obama, for all the lofty rhetoric, didn't deliver for them in middle America. I don't think that they'd signed off on every detail of Trump's plan. And Abbott quickly found that middle Australia didn't want the hard right stuff that he thought he had a complete mandate to do. And so this is the thing. I mean, Labor is, by its own nature, because you've got that left versus right stuff, they don't tend to have, certainly at a federal level, hard left leaders who want to go through. I mean, since Whitlam, really, there hasn't been someone in charge of the show, maybe Latham briefly, but not a prime minister who's wanted to come in and start massively, you know, nationalising everything. It's just...
Well, people are scared of... Change is a really, really tricky thing to sell. And you're right, it's if you're in opposition and the polls are showing that you're probably going to win, you know that people are going to vote against the government, not for you. The last thing you want to do is give the opposition, give your opponent a scare campaign, something saying, well, they're going to do this. Remember the with the GST, with the cake, the John Hewson. Yeah. That's the classic kind of example. We've got politicians who are too scared to come up with sort of new ideas because they can be pretty easily shot down in flames, usually by the likes of me, whose job it is to shoot them down in flames.
Yeah, well, it does give the coalition a difficult sell if they're going to be like if you vote Labor, they might keep Medicare.
No, it's always, oh, they'll spend. But where the Liberal Party, you know, their whole sort of brand strength was, we are the economic managers. And now they don't even have that because, you know, they were going to fix the debt. And now, of course, the debt is right up. So everything kind of that was their territory, they can't really sort of attack Labor on. And yet...
But yet, that's still the perception.
They'll still try.
But
Turnbull would quibble with that point.
Well, they've lost a lot there. And in terms of health and education, the whole Medicare Medicare thing. No, we weren't going to touch it. It's like, when you're kind of, you know, privatising this bit of it and this bit of it and this bit of it, it's kind of touching.
Well, when you put a massive freeze on rebates for GPs, it's kind of hard to argue, oh, no, we're not going to touch Medicare.
Well, but the other thing was, if there's a pattern of repeated behaviours, those messages start not to be believed. But, I mean, as soon as Abbott came in, there was talk of the price signal.
Yep. And
it's just always the way you behave in government surely sets a lasting impression in that sense.
Yeah. Then I think also when you look at education, you've got the government going, oh, we need to improve the education of children. Look at Australia's education system. And it's like, yeah, but you won't fund Gonski, you know, which is kind of answers the problem. And I do think even ordinary Australians going, oh, I don't really trust this government with education.
Well, I think there was a brilliant Onion joke, which was about why people voted for Trump, which I think also sums up why people voted for Abbott, which is sometimes you have to vote against your own interests if you want to vote against the interests of other people.
That's great.
All right, well, that's the current political situation summarised fairly neatly. Let's go just for our finale for a little bit circular here, and let's return to our friends on the crossbench, because Corey Bernardi, we bid him farewell from his stunningly successful career in the Liberal Party of putting his head up and saying things and getting demoted to his own gig, which he's just started, the Australian Conservatives. I'm sorry that he didn't go with the Australian Majority, having written a whole article about what a funny name that was. But anyway,
the Australian Conservatives is where we are. I did like that the NT News tweeted that Corey Bernardi is beginning leadership speculation in his own party just for old time's sake.
I want to write for the NT News one day when I'm grown up.
I once interviewed the people who write the headlines. They're very funny.
They start with Crocs and then they just move out in ever-increasing circles.
It's certainly true. So, look, we're here with the crossbench. And as has been the case in this and to some extent the last parliament, the crossbench is crucial to getting anything done. Bearing that in mind, what's possible? What can Turnbull try and do? And we also need to at some point bid farewell to Ross Carlson in the manner to which we've become accustomed on this podcast.
Oh, right. The candle that burns twice as bright.
Double disqualification. That's his podcast.
Turnbull's still got a lot of conservative crossbenchers. If you look, Lionhelm is essentially a fairly conservative, although gick. Gick is the best I can do. You know, Corey Bernardi is not going to vote, I would think, against much of the Liberal Party stuff.
Well, no, because then he'd have to vote with the opposition, which he cannot do.
He cannot do, exactly.
So it's the safest. So, I mean, he's basically the new Bob Day. There's no way he's not going to vote with the government.
No.
Well, unless they do start proposing marriage equality. But it is hard to see the issue that would split him from his former colleagues.
Hinch is more interesting because he generally, I think, does march to his own drum. Well, he's more likely to...
Yeah, he's a conviction politician.
He is.
Having been convicted on a number of occasions.
And Jackie Lambie, surprisingly, I think, is as well.
She has her...
She has her moments, doesn't she?
She's got a moral compass that's pointed to Tassie.
Yeah, yeah.
Although, I was trying to work out whether it was that she was becoming more nuanced or I was just comparing her with Pauline Hanson more often.
Oh, look, I'm the same. When she first came in, I was sort of, you know, a bit lolly, and now it's like, oh, I don't know. She's like, what's his name? The lovely one whose name I've now completely forgotten. Ricky Muir.
Oh,
and
yeah.
And when he first came in, I was like, ugh. And then by the end, I thought, I really like this fella.
Well, he seemed to be the only senator who read the book on how to be a senator.
Totally.
Like, he just seemed, he was the classic Mr. Smith going to Canberra.
But he was surprisingly...
muscle car.
In a muscle car.
Like, he was a motoring enthusiast, but was quite an environmentalist in some areas. Like, he was a really interesting person that he sort of, you know, had his own ideas about things, and they weren't like Malcolm Roberts' ideas, which is always a good thing.
He definitely has his own ideas about things.
That's completely original. No one's ever had them before or since. Ricky Muir actually seemed to come in and read bills on their merits and actually work out what he thought was reasonable. And so,
or to put it another
Lazarus.
Way, read bills, I think was not necessarily true of anybody else.
We should have a drinking game for Senate Question Time. Every time Malcolm Robert says empirical evidence, we should skull a drink.
We'd be dead in a week.
I know, it'd be funny.
So, look, who knows? It's a complete menagerie. It seems as though, basically, since the first Rudd spill, we've had a situation of rabid crossbenches, hard to do anything. Who knows? It's fascinating watching, but in that period since, when was it, 2010, not much seems to have been achieved, really. I mean, Gillard passed a lot of stuff, but...
A lot of which has now been rolled back.
Where are we actually going? I have no idea what the destination is at this
point. Maybe we don't need a government. Maybe this has been proof of that. done nothing.
Belgium were right.
Well, if we take the New South Wales government's approach on amalgamations, we should probably just amalgamate with New Zealand and much of the South Pacific. If the government's not doing anything, roll us in with Nauru and New Zealand and maybe even Indonesia.
Or secede. All the states can secede and run their own little governments except for Tasmania, who won't have any money. So
isn't that Western Australia's plan every 20 minutes or so? Yeah. They're just like, well, we'll leave then.
And we'll take our GST with us.
But are we going to get an extra state? Like, aren't we talking about far north Queensland becoming its own state?
Well, they are.
Yeah, I say we. I mean they.
Absolutely no chance.
They and Bobcatter.
No one's going to give them 12 more Senate votes, but they can keep dreaming.
Well, this is one of the things that I am fascinated about every time that we talk about the Northern Territory becoming a state, because the thought of 12 Northern Territorian senators, it's going to be like Queensland, only more so.
It would be pretty entertaining.
I did the Northern Territory election this year.
Yes, indeed you did.
It's the best place. They should become a state and I'll do their election. Well, it won't matter to me. It'll still do it. The most fun elections ever.
Does it just end like with Thunderdome? That's what
I had ads with crocodiles eating. You know how there's those boring ads with newspaper clippings? I had crocodiles eating them and stuff. We just had fun.
Yeah. Actual crocodiles?
Mad Max with boats.
Little ones, but
is what it is. Yeah. It's Mad Max in Kakadu with boats and crocs.
And also to run an ad, it's like, you know, $30. So you can just do these really ads.
We should be running more ads in the Northern Territory.
Yeah. We should be plugging this podcast in the NT.
Let's work on that.
And the 2 months of the year, the weather is amazing. The rest of the time, it's like, oh my God, I want to kill myself. But those 2 months are immaculate.
It's 4:00. We really need to check whether or not a challenge is on. Dee, can you quickly look at that? Okay. I might get Andrew P. Street just to deliver a eulogy, as it were, at the political funeral of Senator Rod Carlson, who only a few hours ago had confirmed that, in fact, he was out.
Look, I feel that a star has gone out in the firmament of democracy, with the sad, not just the bankruptcy of Rod Cullerton, but the complete ineligibility to run of Rod Cullerton. Two strikes against him, which he bravely fought with arguments as bold and as colourful as the great state of Western Australia.
Mm. I feel as though someone swiped the key to my heart.
I still find the nobody knows where the Australian Constitution has been since 1990 argument being just elegant in its batshittery.
Who's answered? We don't have an answer to that question.
We don't. We still don't know.
I studied at uni in the late 90s, but clearly I was wasting my time.
I think it's kind of like national treasure. Like it's like the Australian Constitution is hidden in a museum and there's a treasure map on the back. And we need Nicolas Cage, a.k.a. Rod Cullerton, to sort us out. We are the poorer for his absence. Unlike
not
Bob Day,
is,
where it's
yeah.
made no difference at all.
Karen Barlow's just tweeted. She's got this photo of Rod Cullerton just standing there with his hands, you know, in front of him in Parliament House, and she's just put Senator No More. Mr. Cullerton goes to Canberra.
Aww. Is he still at Senator Cullerton?
You can just hear the Arrested
Twitter.
Development Snoopy music playing as he kind of slinks off stage right.
He is the national treasure. Now forget Nicolas Cage. Rod was the national treasure. Look, it's been a delight. We'll catch you on Twitter, D, and Gruen and PM Live. And the 2-hour PM Live, haven't caught that yet.
Yeah, well, we only have to do 1 hour.
Does he do a seat change halfway through?
He does a seat change. The first week or so, because people were on holidays, there was no seat change. And do you know what? 2 hours of live TV, that's actually a lot of information to get your head around, particularly when the other three people are fairly right-wing. And so, you know, that they're all waiting to sort of, you know, jump on you. So there's quite a bit of, you know, last-minute desperate reading in the car before I go.
I've been invited on for several years. Call me Paulie. Call me. And Andrew, of course, we catch you in Fairfax newspapers roughly twice a day, it seems.
It's a lot at the moment. You know, I've got mouths to feed.
All right, you can subscribe on iTunes or your favourite podcasting app. We've got live events coming up. We'll have details about that soon. And catch you next time.
Bye.
Farewell.
Bye.